in the sense that all math describes some real universe. Across the multiverse, all math gets its due. A universe governed by Newton's equations and populated solely by solid billiard balls with no additional internal structure is a real universe. An empty universe with 666 spatial dimensions governed by a higher dimensional version of Einstein's equations is a universe too. If the aliens happened to be right, there would also be universes whose description would stand outside mathematics. But let's hold that possibility off to the side. A multiverse realizing all mathematical equations will be enough to keep us occupied. That's what the ultimate multiverse gives us. Multiverse rationalization. Where the ultimate multiverse differs from the other parallel universe proposals we've encountered is in the reasoning that leads to its consideration. The multiverse theories in previous chapters were not dreamed up to solve a problem or answer a question. Some of them do, or at least claim to, but they weren't developed for that purpose. We've seen that some theorists believe the quantum multiverse resolves the quantum measurement problem. Some believe the cyclic multiverse addresses the question of time's beginning. Some believe the brain multiverse clarifies why gravity is so much weaker than the other forces. Some believe the landscape multiverse gives insight into the observed values of dark energy. Some believe the holographic multiverse explains data emerging from collisions of heavy atomic nuclei. But such applications are secondary. Quantum mechanics was developed to describe the microrealm. Inflationary cosmology was developed to make sense of observed properties of the cosmos. String theory was developed to mediate between quantum mechanics and general relativity. The possibility that these theories generate various multiverses is a byproduct. The ultimate multiverse, by contrast, carries no explanatory weight apart from its assumption of a multiverse. It achieves precisely one goal, cleaving from our to-do list the project of finding an explanation for why our universe adheres to one set of mathematical laws and not another. And it accomplishes this singular feat precisely by introducing a multiverse. Cooked up specifically to address one issue, the ultimate multiverse lacks the independent rationale characterizing the multiverses discussed in earlier chapters. That's my view, but not everyone agrees. There's a philosophical perspective, coming from the structural realist school of thought, that suggests physicists may have fallen prey to a false dichotomy between mathematics and physics. It's common for theoretical physicists to speak of mathematics providing a quantitative language for describing physical reality. I've done so on most every page of this book. But maybe, this perspective suggests, math is more than just a description of reality. Maybe math is reality. It's a peculiar idea. We are not used to thinking of solid reality as being constructed from intangible mathematics. The simulated universes of the previous section provide a concrete and enlightening way to think about it. Consider that most celebrated of knee-jerk reactions, in which Samuel Johnson responded to Bishop Berkeley's claim that matter is a figment of the mind's conjuring by kicking a large stone. Imagine, however, that unbeknownst to Dr. Johnson, his kick happened within a hypothetical, high-fidelity computer simulation. In that simulated world, Dr. Johnson's experience of the stone would be just as convincing as in the historical version. Yet the computer simulation is nothing but a chain of mathematical manipulations that take the computer state at one moment, a complex arrangement of bits, and according to specified mathematical rules, evolves those bits through subsequent arrangements. Which means that were you to intently study the mathematical transformations the computer carried out during Dr. Johnson's demonstration, you'd see right there in the math the kick and the rebound of his foot, as well as the thought and the famous articulation, "I refute it thus." Hook the computer to a monitor or some futuristic interface, and you would see that the mathematically choreographed dancing bits yield Dr. Johnson and his kick. But don't let the simulation's bells and whistles, the computer's hardware, the fancy interface, and so on, obscure the essential fact. Underneath the hood, there'd be nothing but math. Change the mathematical rules, and the dancing bits would tap out a different reality. Now, why stop there? I put Dr. Johnson in a simulation only because that context provides an instructive bridge between mathematics and Dr. Johnson's reality. But the deeper point of this perspective is that the computer simulation is an inessential intermediate step, a mere mental stepping stone between the experience of a tangible world and the abstraction of mathematical equations. The mathematics itself, through the relationships it creates, the connections it establishes, and the transformations it embodies, contains Dr. Johnson, both his actions and his thoughts. You don't need the computer. You don't need the dancing bits. Dr. Johnson is in the mathematics. And once you take on board the idea that mathematics itself can, through its inherent structure, embody any and all aspects of reality, sentient minds, heavy rocks, vigorous kicks, stubbed toes, you're led to envision that our reality is nothing but math. In this way of thinking, everything you're aware of, the sensation of hearing this program, the thoughts you're now having, the plans you're making for dinner, is the experience of mathematics. Reality is how math feels. To be sure, this perspective requires a conceptual leap not everyone will be persuaded to take. Personally, it's a leap I've not taken. But for those who do, the worldview sees math as not just out there, but as the only thing that's out there. A body of mathematics, be it Newton's equations, those of Einstein, or any others, doesn't become real when physical entities arise that instantiate it. Mathematics, all mathematics, already is real. It doesn't require instantiation. Different collections of mathematical equations are different universes. The ultimate multiverse is thus the byproduct of this perspective on mathematics. Max Tegmark of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who has been a strong promoter of the ultimate multiverse, which he has called the mathematical universe hypothesis, justifies this view through a related consideration. The deepest description of the universe should not require concepts whose meaning relies on human experience or interpretation. Reality transcends our existence and so shouldn't, in any fundamental way, depend on ideas of our making. Tegmark's view is that mathematics, thought of as collections of operations, like addition, that act on abstract sets of objects, like the integers, yielding various relations between them, like 1 plus 2 equals 3, is precisely the language for expressing statements that shed human contagion. But what, then, could possibly distinguish a body of mathematics from the universe it depicts? Tegmark argues that the answer is nothing. Were there some feature that did distinguish math from the universe, it would have to be non-mathematical. Otherwise, it could be absorbed into the mathematical depiction, erasing the purported distinction. But according to this line of thought, if the feature were non-mathematical, it must bear human imprint, and so can't be fundamental. Thus, there's no distinguishing what we conventionally call the mathematical description of reality from its physical embodiment. They are the same. There's no switch that turns math on. Mathematical existence is synonymous with physical existence. And since this would be true for any and all math, this provides another road leading us to the ultimate multiverse. While all these arguments are curious to contemplate, I remain skeptical. In evaluating a given multiverse proposal, I'm partial to there being a process, however tentative, a fluctuating inflaton field, collisions between brain worlds, quantum tunneling through the string theory landscape, a wave evolving via the Schrödinger equation, that we can imagine generating the multiverse. I prefer to ground my thinking in a sequence of events that can, at least in principle, result in the given multiverse unfolding. For the ultimate multiverse, it's hard to imagine what such a process could be. the process would need to yield different mathematical laws in different domains. In the inflationary and landscape multiverses, we've seen that the details of how the laws of physics manifest themselves can vary from universe to universe. But this is because of environmental differences, such as the values of certain Higgs fields or the shape of the extra dimensions. The underlying mathematical equations operating across all the universes are the same. So, what process operating within a given set of mathematical laws can change those mathematical laws? Like the number 5 desperately trying to be 6, it seems plainly impossible. However, before settling on that conclusion, consider this. There can be domains that appear as though they are governed by different mathematical rules. Think again about simulated worlds. In discussing Dr. Johnson before, I invoked a computer simulation as a pedagogical device to explain how mathematics may embody the essence of experience. But if we consider such simulations in their own right, as we do in the simulated multiverse, we see that they offer just the process we need. Although the computer hardware on which a simulation is run is subject to the usual laws of physics, the simulated world itself will be founded on the mathematical equations the user happens to choose. From simulation to simulation, the mathematical laws can and generally will vary. As we will now see, this provides a mechanism for generating a particular privileged part of the ultimate multiverse. Simulating Babel. Earlier, I noted that for the kinds of equations we typically study in physics, computer simulations yield only approximations to the mathematics. Such is generally the case when continuous numbers confront a digital computer. For example, in classical physics, assuming as we do in classical physics that space-time is continuous, a batted ball passes through an infinite number of different points as it travels from home plate to left field. Keeping track of a ball through an infinity of locations and of an infinity of possible speeds at those locations will always remain beyond reach. At best, computers can perform highly refined but still approximate calculations, tracking a ball every millionth or billionth or trillionth of a centimeter, for instance. That's fine for many purposes, but it's still an approximation. Quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, by introducing various forms of discreteness, help in some ways, but both make extensive use of continuously varying numbers, values of probability waves, values of fields, and so on. The same reasoning holds for all the other standard equations of physics. A computer can approximate the math, but it can't simulate the equations exactly. There are other types of mathematical functions, however, for which a computer simulation can be absolutely precise. They're part of a class called computable functions, which are functions that can be evaluated by a computer running through a finite set of discrete instructions. The computer may need to cycle through the collection of steps repeatedly, but sooner or later it will produce the exact answer. No originality or novelty is needed at any step. It's just a matter of grinding out the result. In practice, then, to simulate the motion of a batted ball, computers are programmed with equations that are computable approximations to the laws of physics that you learned in high school. Typically, continuous space and time are approximated on a computer by a fine grid. By contrast, a computer trying to calculate a non-computable function will churn away indefinitely without coming to an answer regardless of its speed or memory capacity. Such would be the case for a computer seeking the exact continuous trajectory of that batted ball. For a more qualitative example, imagine a simulated universe in which a computer is programmed to provide a wonderfully efficient simulated chef who provides meals for all those simulated inhabitants and only those simulated inhabitants who don't cook for themselves. As the chef furiously bakes, fries, and broils, he works up quite an appetite. The question is, whom does the computer charge with feeding the chef? Think about it, and it makes your head hurt. The chef can't cook for himself as he only cooks for those who don't cook for themselves. But if the chef doesn't cook for himself, He is among those for whom he is meant to cook. Rest assured, the computer's head would hardly fare better than yours. Non-computable functions are much like this example. They stymie a computer's ability to complete its calculations, and so the simulation being run by the computer would hang. The successful universes constituting the simulated multiverse would therefore be based on computable functions. The discussion suggests an overlap between the simulated and ultimate multiverses. Consider a scaled-down version of the ultimate multiverse that includes only universes arising from computable functions. Then, rather than merely being posited as a resolution to one particular question, why is this universe real while other possible universes are not? The scaled-down version of the ultimate multiverse can emerge from a process. An army of future computer users, perhaps not much different in temperament from today's Second Life enthusiasts, could spawn this multiverse through their insatiable fascination with running simulations based on ever different equations. These users wouldn't generate all universes contained in the mathematical library of Babel, because the ones based on non-computable functions wouldn't get off the ground. But the users would continually work their way through the library's computable wing. The computer scientist Jürgen Schmidhuber, extending earlier ideas of Zuse, has come to a similar conclusion from a different angle. Schmidhuber realized that it's actually easier to program a computer to generate all possible computable universes than it is to program individual computers to generate them one by one. To see why, imagine programming a computer to simulate baseball games. For each game, the amount of information you need to supply is vast. Every detail about every player, physical and mental, every detail about the stadium, the umpires, the weather, and so on. And each new game you simulate requires you to specify yet another mountain of data. However, if you decide to simulate not one or a few games, but every game imaginable, your programming job would be far easier. You just need to set up one master program that systematically makes its way through every possible variable, those that affect the players, the environment, and all other relevant features, and let the program run. Finding any one particular game in the resulting voluminous output would be a challenge, but you'd be assured that sooner or later, every possible game would appear. The point is that whereas specifying one member of a large collection requires a great deal of information, specifying the entire collection can often be much easier. Schmidhuber found that this conclusion applies to simulated universes. A programmer hired to simulate a collection of universes based on specific sets of mathematical equations could take the easy way out. Much like the baseball enthusiast, he could opt to write a single, relatively short program that would generate all computable universes and turn the computer loose. Somewhere among the resulting gargantuan collection of simulated universes, the programmer would find those he'd been hired to simulate. I wouldn't want to be paying for computer usage by the hour, as the turnaround time for generating these simulations would similarly be gargantuan. But I'd happily pay the programmer by the hour, since the instruction set to generate all computable universes would be much less intensive than that required to yield any one universe in particular. Either of these scenarios, a great many users simulating a great many universes, or a master program that simulates them all, is how the simulated multiverse might be generated. And because the resulting universes would be based on a wide variety of different mathematical laws, we can equivalently think of these scenarios as generating part of the ultimate multiverse, the part encompassing universes based on computable mathematical functions. The drawback of generating only part of the ultimate multiverse is that this downsized version less effectively addresses the issue that inspired Nozick's principle of fecundity in the first place. If all possible universes don't exist, if the entire ultimate multiverse is not generated, the question resurfaces of why some equations come to life and others don't. Specifically, we're left wondering why universes based on computable equations hog the spotlight. To continue along this chapter's highly speculative path, Maybe the computable, non-computable division is telling us something. Computable mathematical equations avoid the prickly issues raised in the middle of the last century by penetrating thinkers like Kurt Gödel, Alan Turing, and Alonzo Church. Gödel's famous incompleteness theorem shows that certain mathematical systems necessarily admit true statements that can't be proved within the mathematical system itself. Physicists have long wondered about the possible implications of Gödel's insights for their own work. Might physics, too, necessarily be incomplete, in the sense that some features of the natural world would forever elude our mathematical descriptions? In the context of the downsized ultimate multiverse, the answer is no. Computable mathematical functions, by definition, lie squarely within the bounds of calculation. They are the very functions that admit a procedure by which a computer can successfully evaluate them. And so, if all the universes in a multiverse were based on computable functions, they all would also do an end run around Gödel's theorem. This wing of the Library of Mathematical Babel, this version of the ultimate multiverse, would be free of Gödel's ghost. Maybe that's what singles out computable functions. Would our universe find a place in this multiverse? That is, if and when we put our hands on the final laws of physics, will those laws describe the cosmos using mathematical functions that are computable? Not just approximately computable functions, as is the case with the physical laws we work with today, but exactly computable. No one knows. If so, developments in physics should drive us toward theories in which the continuum plays no role. Discreteness, the core of the computational paradigm, should prevail. Space surely seems continuous, but we've only probed it down to a billionth of a billionth of a meter. It's possible that with more refined probes, we will one day establish that space is fundamentally discrete. For now, the question is open. A similar limited understanding applies to intervals of time. The discoveries recounted in Chapter 9, which yield information capacity of 1 bit per Planck area in any region of space, constitute a major step in the direction of discreteness. But the issue of how far the digital paradigm can be taken remains far from settled. My guess is that whether or not sentient simulations ever come to be, we will indeed find that the world is fundamentally discrete. The roots of reality. In the simulated multiverse, there's no ambiguity regarding which universe is real. That is, which universe lies at the root of the branching tree of simulated worlds. It's the one that houses those computers which, should they crash, would bring down the entire multiverse. A simulated inhabitant might simulate his or her own set of universes on simulated computers, as might the inhabitants of those simulations. But there are still real computers on which all these layered simulations appear as an avalanche of electrical impulses. There's no uncertainty about what facts, patterns, and laws are, in the traditional sense, real. They're the ones at work in the root universe. However, typical simulated scientists across the simulated multiverse may have a different perspective. If these scientists are allowed sufficient autonomy, if the simulants rarely, if ever, tinker with inhabitants' memories or disrupt the natural flow of events, then to judge by our own experiences, we can anticipate that they will make great progress in uncovering the mathematical code that propels their world. And they will treat that code as their laws of nature. Nevertheless, their laws won't necessarily be identical to the laws governing the real universe. Their laws merely need to be good enough in the sense that when they're simulated on a computer, they yield a universe with sentient inhabitants. If there are many distinct sets of mathematical laws that qualify as good enough, there could well be an ever-growing population of simulated scientists convinced of mathematical laws that, far from being fundamental, were simply chosen by whoever has programmed their simulation. If we are typical inhabitants in such a multiverse, this reasoning suggests that what we normally think of as science, a discipline charged with revealing fundamental truths about reality, the root reality operating at the base of the tree, would be undermined. It's an uncomfortable possibility, but not one that keeps me up at night. Until I get my breath taken away by seeing a sentient simulation, I won't consider seriously the proposition that I am now in one. And taking the long view, even if sentient simulations are achieved one day, itself a big if, I can well imagine that when a civilization's technical capabilities first enable such simulations, their appeal would be tremendous. But would that appeal be long-lived? I suspect the novelty of creating artificial worlds whose inhabitants are kept unaware of their simulated status would wear thin. There's just so much reality TV you can watch. Instead, if I allow my imagination to run free within this speculative territory, my sense is that staying power would reside with applications that developed interactions between the simulated and the real worlds. Perhaps simulated inhabitants would be able to migrate into the real world or be joined in the simulated world by their real biological counterparts. In time, the distinction between real and simulated beings might become anachronistic. Such seamless unions strike me as a more probable outcome. In that case, the simulated multiverse would contribute to the expanse of reality, our expanse of reality, our real reality, in the most tangible way. It would become an intrinsic part of what we mean by reality. Chapter 11, The Limits of Inquiry, Multiverses and the Future. Isaac Newton cracked the scientific enterprise wide open. He discovered that a few mathematical equations could describe the way things move, both here on Earth and up in space. Considering the power and simplicity of his results, one could easily have imagined that Newton's equations reflected eternal truths etched into the bedrock of the cosmos. But Newton himself didn't think so. He believed that the universe was far more rich and mysterious than his laws implied. Later in life, he famously reflected, "I do not know what I may appear to the world, but to myself, I seem to have only been a boy playing on the seashore, diverting myself in now and then finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, whilst the great ocean of truth lay before me all undiscovered." The centuries since have abundantly affirmed this. I'm glad. Had Newton's equations enjoyed unlimited reach, accurately describing phenomena in any context, however big or small, heavy or light, fast or slow, the subsequent scientific odyssey would have taken on a distinctly different character. Newton's equations teach us much about the world, but their unlimited validity would have meant that the cosmic flavor was vanilla through and through. Once you understood physics on everyday scales, you'd be done. The same story would have held all the way up and all the way down. In continuing Newton's explorations, scientists have ventured into realms far beyond the reach of his equations. What we've learned has required sweeping changes in our understanding of the nature of reality. Such changes are not made lightly. They are closely examined by the community of scientists, and they are often sharply resisted. Only when the evidence reaches a critical abundance is the new view embraced, which is just as it should be. There's no need to rush to judgment. Reality will wait. The central fact, most forcefully emphasized by the last 100 years of theoretical and experimental progress, is that common experience fails to be a trustworthy guide for excursions that wander beyond everyday circumstances. But for all the radically new physics encountered in extreme conditions, described by general relativity, quantum mechanics, and, should it prove correct, string theory, the fact that radically new ideas would be required is not surprising. The basic assumption of science is that regularities and patterns exist on all scales. But as Newton himself anticipated, there's no reason to expect the patterns we directly encounter to be recapitulated on all scales. The surprise would have been to find no surprises. The same is undoubtedly true regarding what physics will reveal in the future. A given generation of scientists can never know whether the long view of history will judge their work as a diversion as passing fascination, as a stepping stone, or as having revealed insights that will stand the test of time. Such local uncertainty is balanced by one of physics' most gratifying features, global stability. That is, new theories generally do not erase those they supplant. As we've discussed, while new theories may require acclimation to new perspectives on the nature of reality, they almost never render past discoveries irrelevant. Instead, they incorporate and extend them. Because of this, the story of physics has maintained an impressive coherence. In this program, we've explored a candidate for the next major development in this story, the possibility that our universe is part of a multiverse. The journey has taken us through 9 variations on the multiverse theme: the quilted multiverse, the inflationary multiverse, the brain multiverse, the cyclic multiverse, the landscape multiverse, the quantum multiverse, the holographic multiverse, the simulated multiverse, and the ultimate multiverse. Although the various proposals differ widely in detail, they all suggest that our common sense picture of reality is only part of a grander whole, and they all bear the indelible mark of human ingenuity and creativity. But determining whether any of these ideas goes beyond mathematical musings of the human mind will require more insight, knowledge, calculation, experiment, and observation than we've so far achieved. A final reckoning on whether parallel universes will be written into the next chapter of the story of physics must therefore also await the perspective that only the future can bring. As with the metaphorical book of nature, so with the book you're hearing. In this last chapter, I'd be delighted to pull all the pieces together and answer the subject's most essential question: universe or multiverse? But I can't. That's the nature of explorations that brush the edge of knowledge. Instead, to catch a glimpse of where the multiverse concept might be headed, as well as to emphasize the essential highlights of where it now stands, here are 5 central questions with which physicists will continue to grapple in the years ahead. Is the Copernican pattern fundamental? Regularities and patterns, evident in observations and in mathematics, are essential to formulating physical laws. Patterns of a different sort, in the nature of the physical laws accepted by each successive generation, are also revealing. Such patterns reflect how scientific discovery has shifted humankind's perspective on its place in the cosmic order. Over the course of nearly 5 centuries, the Copernican progression has been a dominant theme. From the rising and setting of the sun to the motion of constellations across the night sky, to the leading role we each play in our mind's inner world, experience abounds with clues suggesting that we're a central hub around which the cosmos revolves. But the objective methods of scientific discovery have steadily corrected this perspective. At nearly every turn, we found that were we not here, the cosmic order would hardly differ. We've had to give up our belief in Earth's centrality among our cosmic neighbors, the sun's centrality in the galaxy, the Milky Way's centrality among the galaxies, and even the centrality of protons, neutrons, and electrons, the stuff of which we're made, in the cosmic recipe. There was a time when evidence contrary to long-held collective delusions of grandeur was viewed as a frontal assault on human worth. With practice, we've gotten better at valuing enlightenment. The trek in this book has been toward what may be the capstone Copernican correction. Our universe itself may not be central to any cosmic order. Much as with our planet, star, and galaxy, our universe may merely be one among a great many. The idea that reality based on a multiverse extends the Copernican pattern and perhaps completes it is cause for curiosity. But what elevates the multiverse concept above idle speculation is a key fact that we've now repeatedly encountered. Scientists have not been on a hunt for ways to extend the Copernican revolution. They've not been plotting in darkened laboratories for ways to complete the Copernican pattern. Instead, scientists have been doing what they always do. Using data and observations as a guide, they've been formulating mathematical theories to describe the fundamental constituents of matter and the forces that govern how those constituents behave, interact, and evolve. Remarkably, when diligently following the trail these theories blaze, scientists have run smack into one potential multiverse after another. Take a trip along a great many of the most traveled scientific highways, stay moderately attentive, and you'll encounter a diverse assortment of multiverse candidates. They're harder to avoid than they are to find. Perhaps future discoveries will cast a different light on the series of Copernican corrections, but from our current vantage point, the more we understand, the less central we appear. Should the scientific considerations we've discussed in earlier chapters continue to push us toward multiverse-based explanations, it would be the natural step toward completing the Copernican Revolution 500 years in the making. Can scientific theories that invoke a multiverse be tested? Although the multiverse concept fits snugly within the Copernican template, it differs qualitatively from our earlier migrations from center stage. By invoking realms that may be forever beyond our ability to examine, either with any degree of precision or, in some cases, even at all, multiverses seemingly erect substantial barriers to scientific knowledge. Regardless of one's view of humanity's place in the cosmic arrangement, a widely held assumption has been that through conscientious experimentation, observation, and mathematical calculation, the capacity for gaining deeper understanding is boundless. But if we're part of a multiverse, a reasonable expectation is that at best, we can learn about our universe, our little corner of the cosmos. More distressing is the worry that by invoking a multiverse, we enter the domain of theories that can't be tested, theories that rely on just-so stories, relegating everything we observe to the way things just happen to be here. As I've argued, however, the multiverse concept is more nuanced. There are various ways in which a theory that involves a multiverse might offer testable predictions. For instance, while the particular universes constituting a given multiverse may differ considerably, because they emerge from a common theory, there may be features they all share. Failure to find those features through measurements we undertake here in the one universe to which we have access would prove that multiverse proposal wrong. Confirmation of those features, especially if they're novel, would build confidence that the proposal was right. Or, if there aren't features common to all universes, correlations between physical features can provide another class of testable predictions. For example, we've seen that if all universes whose particle roster includes, say, an electron, also include an as yet undetected particle species, failure to find the particle through experiments undertaken here in our universe would rule out the multiverse proposal. Confirmation would build confidence. More complicated correlations, such as those universes whose particle roster includes all the known particles, also contain a new particle species which similarly yield testable, falsifiable predictions. In the absence of such tight correlations, the manner in which physical features vary from universe to universe can also provide predictions. Across a given multiverse, for example, the cosmological constant might take on a wide range of values. But if the vast majority of universes have a cosmological constant whose value agrees with what measurements have found here, confidence in that multiverse would deservedly grow. Finally, even if most universes in a given multiverse have properties that differ from ours, there's one more diagnostic we can bring into play. We can invoke anthropic reasoning. Consider only those universes in the multiverse hospitable to our form of life. If the vast majority of this subclass of universes has properties that agree with ours, if our universe is typical among those universes in which the conditions allow us to live, confidence in the multiverse would build. If we're atypical, we can't rule the theory out, but that's a familiar limitation of statistical reasoning. Unlikely outcomes can and sometimes do happen. Even so, the less typical we are, the less compelling the given multiverse proposal would be. If among all life-supporting universes in a given multiverse, our universe would stick out like a sore thumb, That would provide a strong argument to deem that multiverse proposal irrelevant. To probe a multiverse proposal quantitatively, therefore, we must determine the demographics of the universes that populate it. It's not enough to know the possible universes the multiverse proposal allows. We must determine the detailed features of the actual universes to which the proposal gives rise. This requires understanding the cosmological processes that bring the various universes of a given multiverse proposal into existence. Testable predictions can then emerge from the way physical features vary from universe to universe across the multiverse. Whether this sequence of evaluations yields sharp results is something that can only be assessed multiverse by multiverse. But the conclusion is that theories that involve other universes, realms we can't access now or perhaps ever, can still provide testable and hence falsifiable predictions. Can we test the multiverse theories we've encountered? In the course of theoretical research, physical intuition is vital. Theorists need to navigate a bewildering array of possibilities. Should I try this equation or that? Invoke that pattern or this? The best physicists have sharp and wonderfully accurate hunches or gut feelings about which directions are promising and which are likely to be fruitless. But that happens behind the scenes. When scientific proposals are brought forward, they are not judged by hunches or gut feelings. Only one standard is relevant: a proposal's ability to explain or predict experimental data and astronomical observations. Therein lies the singular beauty of science. As we struggle toward deeper understanding, we must give our creative imagination ample room to explore. We must be willing to step outside conventional ideas and established frameworks. But unlike the wealth of other human activities through which the creative impulse is channeled, science supplies a final reckoning, a built-in assessment of what's right and what's not. A complication of scientific life in the late 20th and early 21st centuries is that some of our theoretical ideas have soared past our ability to test or observe. String theory has for some time been the poster child for this situation. The possibility that we're part of a multiverse provides an even more sprawling example. I've laid out a general prescription for how a multiverse proposal might be testable, but at our current level of understanding, none of the multiverse theories we've encountered yet meet the criteria. With ongoing research, this situation could greatly improve. Our investigations of the landscape multiverse, for example, are in the earliest stages. Detailed maps of the string landscape's mountainous terrain have yet to be drawn. Like ancient seafarers, we have a rough sense of what's out there, but it will require extensive mathematical explorations to map the lay of the land. With such knowledge in hand, the next step will be to determine how these potential universes are distributed across the corresponding landscape multiverse. The essential physical process, the creation of bubble universes through quantum tunneling, is well understood in principle, but has yet to be examined with quantitative depth in string theory. Various research groups, including my own, have undertaken initial reconnaissance, but there is vast terrain yet to scout. As we've heard in earlier chapters, a variety of similar uncertainties afflict the other multiverse proposals too. No one knows whether it will take years, decades, or even longer for observational and theoretical progress to extract detailed predictions from any given multiverse. Should the current situation persist, we'll face a choice. Do we define science, respectable science, as including only those ideas, realms, and possibilities that fall within the capacity of contemporary human beings on planet Earth to test or observe? Or do we take a more expansive view and consider as scientific ideas that might be testable with technological advances we can imagine achieving in the next 100 years, the next 200 years, longer? Or do we take a still more expansive view? Do we allow science to follow any and all paths it reveals, to travel in directions that radiate from experimentally confirmed concepts but that may lead our theorizing into hidden realms that lie, perhaps permanently, beyond human reach. There's no clear-cut answer. It is here that personal scientific taste comes to the fore. I understand well the impulse to tether scientific investigations to those propositions that can be tested now or in the near future. This is, after all, how we built the scientific edifice. But I find it parochial to bound our thinking by the arbitrary limits imposed by where we are, when we are, and who we are. Reality transcends these limits, so it's to be expected that sooner or later, the search for deep truths will too. My taste is for the expansive, but I draw the line at ideas that have no possibility of being confronted meaningfully by experiment or observation, not because of human frailty or technological hurdles, but because of the proposal's inherent nature. Of the multiverses we've considered, only the full-blown version of the ultimate multiverse falls into this netherland. If absolutely every possible universe is included, then no matter what we measure or observe, the ultimate multiverse will nod and embrace our result. The other 8 multiverses, they avoid this pitfall. Each emerges from a well-motivated, logical chain of reasoning, and each is open to judgment. Should observations provide convincing evidence that the spatial expanse is finite, the quilted multiverse would drop from consideration. Should confidence in inflationary cosmology erode, perhaps because more precise cosmic microwave background data can be explained only by assuming a contorted and hence unconvincing inflaton potential energy curve, the prominence of the inflationary multiverse would diminish too. Should string theory suffer a theoretical setback, perhaps through the discovery of a subtle mathematical flaw showing that the theory is inconsistent, as early researchers initially thought was the case, the motivation for its various multiverses would evaporate. Conversely, observations of patterns in the microwave background radiation expected from bubble collisions could provide direct supporting evidence for the inflationary multiverse. Accelerator experiments searching for supersymmetric particles, missing energy signatures, and mini black holes could bolster the case for string theory and the brain multiverse, while evidence for bubble collisions could also provide support for the landscape variety. Detection of gravitational wave imprints from the early universe, or lack thereof, could distinguish between cosmology based on the inflationary paradigm and that of the cyclic multiverse. Quantum mechanics, in its many worlds guise, gives rise to the quantum multiverse. Should future research show that the equations of quantum mechanics, however reliable they've been so far, require small modifications to match more refined data, this type of multiverse could be ruled out. A modification of quantum theory that compromises the property of linearity, on which we relied extensively in Chapter 8, would do just that. We've noted as well that there are in-principle tests of the quantum multiverse, experiments whose results depend on whether or not Everett's many-worlds picture is correct. The experiments are beyond what we can carry out now and perhaps always, but that's because they're fantastically difficult, not because some inherent feature of the quantum multiverse itself renders them fundamentally undoable. The holographic multiverse emerges from considerations of established theories, general relativity and quantum mechanics, and receives its strongest theoretical support from string theory. Calculations based on holography are already making tentative contact with experimental results at the relativistic heavy ion collider, and all indications are that such experimental links will grow more robust in the future. Whether one views the holographic multiverse merely as a useful mathematical device or as evidence for holographic reality is a matter of opinion. We must await future work, theoretical and experimental, in order to build a stronger case for the physical interpretation. The simulated multiverse rests not on any one theoretical structure, but rather on the relentless rise of computational power. The linchpin assumption is that sentience is not fundamentally tied to a particular substrate, the brain, but is an emergent characteristic of a certain variety of information processing. It's a highly debatable proposition with passionate arguments advanced on both sides. Maybe future research on the brain and on the nature of consciousness will undermine the idea of self-aware thinking machines, and maybe not. One means for judging this multiverse proposal, though, is clear. Should our descendants one day observe or interact with or virtually visit or become part of a convincing simulated world, the issue would, for all practical purposes, be settled. The simulated multiverse, at least in theory, might also be linked to a pared-down version of the ultimate multiverse that includes only universes based on computable mathematical structures. Unlike the full-blown version of the ultimate multiverse, this more limited incarnation has a genesis story that lifts it beyond mere assertion. The users, real and simulated, who are behind the simulated multiverse will, by definition, be simulating computable mathematical structures and thus will have the capacity to generate the limited form of the ultimate multiverse. Gaining experimental or observational insight into the validity of any of the multiverse proposals is surely a long shot, but it's not an impossibility. And with the immensity of the potential payoff, if the exploration of multiverses is where the natural course of theoretical research takes us, we must follow the trail to see where it leads. How does a multiverse affect the nature of scientific explanation? Sometimes science focuses on details. It tells us why planets travel in elliptical orbits, why the sky is blue, why water is transparent, and why my desk is solid. However familiar these facts may be, it's wondrous that we've been able to explain them. Sometimes science takes a larger view. It reveals that we live within a galaxy containing a few hundred billion stars. It establishes that ours is but one of hundreds of billions of galaxies, and it provides evidence for unseen dark energy permeating every nook and cranny of this vast arena. Looking back just 100 years to a time when the universe was thought to be static and populated solely by the Milky Way galaxy, we can rightly celebrate the magnificent picture science has since painted. Sometimes science does something else. Sometimes it challenges us to re-examine our views of science itself. The usual centuries-old scientific framework envisions that when describing a physical system, a physicist needs to specify three things. We've seen all three in various contexts, but it's useful to gather them together here. First are the mathematical equations describing the relevant physical laws. For example, these might be Newton's laws of motion, Maxwell's equations of electricity and magnetism, or Schrödinger's equation of quantum mechanics. Second are the numerical values of all constants of nature that appear in the mathematical equations. For example, the constants determining the intrinsic strength of gravity and the electromagnetic forces, or those determining the masses of the fundamental particles. Third, the physicist must specify the system's initial conditions, such as a baseball being hit from home plate at a particular speed in a particular direction, or an electron starting out with a 50% probability of being found at Grant's tomb and an equal probability of being found at Strawberry Fields. The equations then determine what things will be like at any subsequent time. Both classical and quantum physics subscribe to this framework. They differ only in that classical physics purports to tell us how things will definitely be at a given moment, while quantum physics provides the probability that things will be one way or another. When it comes to predicting where a batted ball will land or how an electron will move through a computer chip or a model Manhattan, this three-step process is demonstrably powerful. Yet when it comes to describing the totality of reality, the three steps invite us to ask deeper questions. Can we explain the initial conditions, how things were at some purportedly earliest moment? Can we explain the values of the constants, the particle masses, force strengths, and so on which those laws depend? Can we explain why a particular set of mathematical equations describes one or another aspect of the physical universe? The various multiverse proposals we've discussed have the potential to profoundly shift our thinking on these questions. In the quilted multiverse, the physical laws across the constituent universes are the same, but the particle arrangements differ. Different particle arrangements now reflect different initial conditions in the past. In this multiverse, therefore, our perspective on the question of why the initial conditions in our universe were one way or another shifts. Initial conditions can and generally will vary from universe to universe, so there is no fundamental explanation for any particular arrangement. Asking for such an explanation is asking the wrong kind of question. It's invoking single universe mentality in a multiverse setting. Instead, the question we should ask is whether somewhere in the multiverse is a universe whose particle arrangement, and hence initial conditions, agrees with what we see here. Better still, can we show that such universes abound? If so, the deep question of initial conditions would be explained with a shrug of the shoulders. In such a multiverse, the initial conditions of our universe would be in no more need of an explanation than the fact that somewhere in New York is a shoe store that carries your size. In the inflationary multiverse, the constants of nature can and generally will vary from bubble universe to bubble universe. Recall from Chapter 3 that environmental differences, the different Higgs field values permeating each bubble, give rise to different particle masses and force properties. The same holds true in the brain multiverse, the cyclic multiverse, and the landscape multiverse, where the form of string theory's extra dimensions, together with various differences in fields and fluxes, result in universes with different features. From the electron's mass to whether there even is an electron, to the strength of electromagnetism, to whether there is an electromagnetic force, to the value of the cosmological constant, and so on. In the context of these multiverses, asking for an explanation of the particle and force properties we measure is once again asking the wrong kind of question. It's a question born of single universe thinking. Instead, we should ask whether in any of these multiverses there's a universe with the physical properties we measure. Better would be to show that universes with our physical features are abundant, or at least are abundant among all those universes that support life as we know it. But much as it's meaningless to ask for the word with which Shakespeare wrote Macbeth, so it's meaningless to ask the equations to pick out the values of the particular physical features we see here. The simulated and ultimate multiverses are horses of a different color. They don't emerge from particular physical theories, yet they too have the potential to shift the nature of our questions. In these multiverses, the mathematical laws governing the individual universes vary. Thus, much as with varying initial conditions and constants of nature, varying laws suggest that it's as misguided to ask for an explanation of the particular laws in operation here. Different universes have different laws. We experience the ones we do because these are among the laws compatible with our existence. Collectively, we see that the multiverse proposals we've discussed render prosaic three primary aspects of the standard scientific framework that in a single universe setting are deeply mysterious. In various multiverses, the initial conditions, the constants of nature, and even the mathematical laws are no longer in need of explanation. Should we believe mathematics? Nobel laureate Steven Weinberg once wrote, "Our mistake is not that we take our theories too seriously, but that we do not take them seriously enough." It is always hard to realize that these numbers and equations we play with at our desks have something to do with the real world. Weinberg was referring to the pioneering results of Ralph Alpher, Robert Hermann, and George Gamow on the cosmic microwave background radiation, which I described in Chapter 3. Although the predicted radiation is a direct consequence of general relativity combined with basic cosmological physics, it rose to prominence only after being discovered theoretically twice, a dozen years apart, and then being observed through a benevolent act of serendipity. To be sure, Weinberg's remark has to be applied with care. Although his desk has played host to an inordinate amount of mathematics that has proved relevant to the real world, far from every equation with which we theorists tinker rises to that level. In the absence of compelling experimental or observational results, deciding which mathematics should be taken seriously is as much art as it is science. Indeed, this issue is central to all we've discussed in this book. It has also informed the book's title. The breadth of multiverse proposals we've covered might suggest a panorama of hidden realities, but I've titled this book in the singular to reflect the unique and uniquely powerful theme that underlies them all, the capacity of mathematics to reveal secreted truths about the workings of the world. Centuries of discovery have made this abundantly evident. Monumental upheavals in physics have emerged time and again from vigorously following mathematics' lead. Einstein's own complex dance with mathematics provides a revealing case study. In the late 1800s, when James Clerk Maxwell realized that light was an electromagnetic wave, his equations showed that light speed should be about 300,000 kilometers per second, close to the value experimenters had measured. A nagging loose end was that his equations left unanswered the question, 300,000 kilometers per second relative to what? Scientists pursued the makeshift resolution that an invisible substance permeating space, the ether, provided the unseen standard of rest. But in the early 20th century, Einstein argued that scientists needed to take Maxwell's equations more seriously. If Maxwell's equations didn't refer to a standard of rest, then there was no need for a standard of rest. Light speed, Einstein forcefully declared, is 300,000 kilometers per second relative to anything. Although the details are of historical interest, I'm describing this episode for the larger point. Everyone had access to Maxwell's mathematics, but it took the genius of Einstein to embrace the mathematics fully. And with that move, Einstein broke through to the special theory of relativity, overturning centuries of thought regarding space, time, matter, and energy. During the next decade, in the course of developing the general theory of relativity, Einstein became intimately familiar with vast areas of mathematics that most physicists of his day knew little or nothing about. As he groped toward general relativity's final equations, Einstein displayed a master's skill in molding these mathematical constructs with the firm hand of physical intuition. A few years later, when he received the good news that observations of the 1919 solar eclipse confirmed general relativity's prediction that starlight should travel along curved trajectories, Einstein confidently noted that had the observational results been different, he would have been very sorry for the dear Lord, since the theory is correct. I'm sure that convincing data contravening general relativity would have changed Einstein's tune. But the remark captures well how a set of mathematical equations, through their sleek internal logic, their intrinsic beauty, and their potential for wide-ranging applicability, can seemingly radiate reality. Nevertheless, there was a limit to how far Einstein was willing to follow his own mathematics. Einstein did not take the general theory of relativity seriously enough to believe its prediction of black holes, or its prediction that the universe was expanding. As we've seen, others, including Friedman, Lamette, and Schwarzschild, embraced Einstein's equations more fully than he, and their achievements have set the course of cosmological understanding for nearly a century. By contrast, during the last 20 or so years of his life, Einstein threw himself into mathematical investigations, passionately striving for the prized achievement of a unified theory of physics. In assessing this work, based on what we now know, one can't help but conclude that during those years, Einstein was too heavily guided, some might say blinded, by the thicket of equations with which he was constantly surrounded. And so, even Einstein, at various times in his life, made the wrong decision regarding which equations to take seriously and which to not. The third revolution in modern theoretical physics, quantum mechanics, provides another case study, one of direct relevance to the story I've told in this book. Schrödinger wrote down his equation for how quantum waves evolve in 1926. For decades, the equation was viewed as relevant only to the domain of small things, molecules, atoms, and particles. But in 1957, Hugh Everett echoed Einstein's Maxwellian charge of a half century earlier, take the math seriously. Everett argued that Schrödinger's equation should apply to everything because all things material, regardless of size, are made from molecules, atoms, and subatomic particles. And as we've seen, this led Everett to the many worlds approach to quantum mechanics and to the quantum multiverse. More than 50 years later, we still don't know if Everett's approach is right. But by taking the mathematics underlying quantum theory seriously, fully seriously, he may have discovered one of the most profound revelations of scientific exploration. The other multiverse proposals similarly rely on a belief that mathematics is tightly stitched into the fabric of reality. The ultimate multiverse takes this perspective to its furthermost incarnation. Mathematics, according to the ultimate multiverse, is reality. But even with their less panoptic view on the connection between mathematics and reality, the other multiverse theories we've discussed owe their genesis to mathematical calculations played with by theorists sitting at desks and scribbling in notebooks and writing on chalkboards and programming computers. Whether invoking general relativity, quantum mechanics, string theory, or mathematical insight more broadly, the parallel universe proposals arise only because we assume that mathematical theorizing can guide us toward hidden truths. Only time will tell if this assumption takes the underlying mathematical theories too seriously, or perhaps not seriously enough. If some or all of the mathematics that's compelled us to think about parallel worlds proves relevant to reality, Einstein's famous query, asking whether the universe has the properties it does simply because no other universe is possible, would have a definite answer. No. Our universe is not the only one possible. Its properties could have been different, and in many of the multiverse proposals, the properties of the other member universes would be different. In turn, seeking a fundamental explanation for why certain things are the way they are would be pointless. Instead, statistical likelihood or plain happenstance would be firmly inserted in our understanding of a cosmos that would be profoundly vast. I don't know if this is how things will turn out. No one does. But it's only through fearless engagement that we can learn our own limits. It's only through the rational pursuit of theories, even those that whisk us into strange and unfamiliar domains, that we stand a chance of revealing the expanse of reality.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Laws of the Cosmos by Brian Greene. This program was produced by Kelly Gilday and directed by David Rapkin. Original music by Alan Green. Copyright 1962-1963. Copyright renewed in 1987. Text copyright 2011 by Brian Greene. Production copyright 2011, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.